And now it's the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this episode is Tina Nilsson Hodges. Tina, it's good to have you here this morning.
Thank you so much, Eric.
So I forgot to turn your microphone up, so we missed the very beginning of what you said, but that we caught the end of it.
Good morning.
Good morning. The way we start the show is with a huge question. Who are you? What do we need to know about how you aspire to live, what you've done, the labels you wear to start this conversation?
It has been really an interesting journey for me, pausing in my life to reflect on that question in preparation for today, making time in the nooks and crannies of a very full life. So I want to first start by expressing gratitude to you for giving me that opportunity. So when I think about who I am, I think about how I'm rooted in my place and in my family. I think first of, I want to speak to my grandmother, who is now 97 years old. Cool. I'm probably one of the only 55-year-old people blessed to have a living grandmother, or among the few anyway. And she immigrated to this country from Norway at the age of around 30, and my father was 10. He was the eldest in his family. And that story has been one that has really made me deeply identify with the history of this country and this place as sure. One of drawing immigrants and also experiencing all of the kinds of trials and tribulations that you experience when you're uprooted from your family and your home place and suddenly find yourself in a new place starting life over. And In rural upstate, this was they settled near Binghamton, New York, and in that space, there were no English as a second language programs for people who spoke Norwegian, sure. in particular. Right. And so, you know, my father, who was a free spirit, brilliant, kind, and wonderful young boy, you know, had to make his way in a very different, you know, social environment. Mm-hmm. My mother's family actually came here from the New York City area, having ancestry that goes back to the 1700s down in the New York City area, so more of a Dutch and German influence. And sure. She came here when my grandmother decided, this was in the 1940s, decided that she wasn't cut out for motherhood and she was going to leave my mother and her husband at the time. And he brought her here as a, to live with his grandmother and, or his mother and father. So it's mine first is a story of becoming rooted in this place. Mm-hmm, I feel deeply connected to upstate New York, and have made the choice to come here to Ithaca as a way of not doing what a lot of people in my generation have chosen to do, which is find some place, you know, else out there in the
far
world,
away, yeah.
far away, but yeah. to stay, you know, stay close and stay rooted. And so I have two beautiful sons that have come out of a partnership with my husband, who grew up in the Vestal area near Binghamton, who is a, we're celebrating 30 years of marriage this month. And the big question, who am I? coming back to
it's
that.
It's a big question. Yeah.
So, well, yeah. In part, I mean, I feel like I am who I am in relation to other people.
That's
and the
definitely
people.
One way to do it, yes.
And I have had a, a rich opportunity to build a foundational, of who I am through relationships with other people who've nurtured and loved me throughout my life. And also the experience at about 10 years old myself, mm-hmm. where having lived for the first decade of my life in a house next door to my grandmother that my father built along with his siblings, a big life change where my parents separated, my father became ill, and suddenly I found myself living in a different place and with a stepfather and also in a trailer park that was, 10 miles away from where my grandmother lived. And so, a very big life change for
sure,
a 10-year-old.
Sure.
What other kinds of things do people say in response to your question?
You're good. You're absolutely good. And I mean, the thing that you said that was a little different was, unlike many of your generation, you chose to remain rooted, near where you grew up. And I come from a place where five generations of my ancestors are buried within 6 miles of each other.
That's awesome.
It's like a shtetl. But there was no opportunity there, and people have left. It's the population has lost 75% or more in the last 120 years. Mm-hmm. So it's a wild setting, but here. You came of age at about the time, in 1973, the oil embargo meant that the really long moves that people had taken for the prior 20, 25 years mm-hmm. stopped happening as much.
Yes.
And they began to decrease. So people have been a little more likely to do that. And you were kind of at the mm-hmm. beginning of that trend, mm-hmm. Which mm-hmm. is an interesting place to be historically.
Yes, indeed. So many things that we're reflecting on the historical moment and how that impacts us.
And a lot of that had to do with energy and mm-hmm. the way the oil embargo was about energy.
I totally remember that too.
So you also brought some music with you. You want to start with Redemption Song?
Sure.
Or did you? I mean, actually, I should ask you, what would you like to begin?
Well, that's a really good question. I would say, let's start with Redemption Song.
Yes, they rabbi sold I to the merchant ships. Minutes after they took I from the bottomless pit, but my hand was made strong by the hand of the Almighty. We forward in this generation. Triumphantly, won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? 'Cause all I ever have, redemption songs, redemption songs. Emancipate yourselves from mental slavery. None but ourselves can free our minds. Have no fear for atomic energy, 'cause none of them can stop the time. How long shall they kill our prophets while we stand aside and look? Ooh, some say it's just a part of it. We've got to fulfill the book. Won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? 'Cause all I ever have, redemption songs, redemption songs, redemption songs. Yourselves from mental slavery. None but ourselves can free our mind. Oh, have no fear for atomic energy, 'cause none of them can stop at the time. How long shall they kill our prophets while we stand aside and look? Yes, some say it's just a part of it. We've got to fulfill the book. Won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? 'Cause all I ever have, redemption songs, all I.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. This is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this episode is Tina Nilsson Hodges. So Tina, given the life that you value living now, what did you have to learn to know how to try to live that? What did you have to go through?
The timing of that question is perfect, just having learned to listen to Redemption Song.
Uh-huh.
I had to learn how to step in with a beating heart and to follow my gut. I had to decide that I was going to go for it, and which is not something I cultivated as a child. I, you know, after that big life change I spoke of, I became much more interior, much more mm-hmm. protected and guarded.
Right, you withdrew a bit.
I withdrew. I was the quiet student in the classroom. You know, I earned good grades, but I wasn't. You know, I protected myself.
Sure.
And what I had to learn was to step out. And the reason I chose Redemption Song is because it's powerful resonance for me in terms of particularly the line, you know, emancipate yourself from mental slavery. None but ourselves will free our minds. In a graduate English class at Binghamton University. By the way, I was a first generation college student, and so I that was blazing new trails. That was another stepping in. I chose to break from the mold of the presentations and to sing this song a cappella as part of my my lesson plan. It was like a demonstration lesson plan for teaching, and so. And that took a lot of courage, and it made a big impact, you know, on my professor and on the people within the room. And it helped me to shift, you know, how I saw myself and my own possibilities. And again, coming from a place of feeling, you know, not necessarily learning to tap into what I, you know, who I am and bring that to the world through my own educational experience or through my family experience, you know, that was a pretty profound moment for me.
Yeah, yes, absolutely. And when you start singing your hope and trust, you're in effect and turning education into that quality of stepping out, it becomes an act of worship. In what that's kind of historically meant, which we don't really have much. We watch TV, we have entertainment, but we don't have actual worship, which is putting ourselves out there to engage a reality far greater than ourselves in the presence of others we cannot fully understand or control. And when you do that, oftentimes it opens up incredible possibilities.
Wow, I had never thought of it in that way before.
But it can be very scary for yourself and for those around you.
Absolutely.
Because we're not supposed to be out there, and we become somewhat unpredictable.
Right.
And we do things that don't necessarily fit the script.
That's right. And actually, you know, I realized again in reflecting, thinking, and what little reflection I was able to do coming in here today is how many times in my life that the most important turning points have been because I've chosen to step out and step in. Like when I, you know, again, as a working class student, no family members who were Rotarians, I chose to throw my hat in the ring and apply to become a Rotary exchange student. And I was chosen to go to Japan for a year when I was in high school. Big life changer. And I remember the moment in the interview when they asked me, I took dance classes, and they said, well, could you show us a dance that you're working on right now? And I was, you know, sitting in front of like a group of peers from different schools.
Sure.
And I just said, okay, I did it. It was pretty simple. We were early on in the process. But I think that helped them to see me as someone who could step into a whole different culture, and that was a life changer. You know, so was moving to Ithaca.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So
why the move to Ithaca? And in terms of people who are truly locally rooted, to move 55 miles is, or 50 miles is an uprooting.
Yes, interesting. Yeah, yeah. Well, I moved to Ithaca because I was following my desire to find a community of people that were interested in creating a school that would, a school for education for sustainability, which at the time, 17 years ago, was a rather new word in education.
Right.
Because, and that was rooted in my experience as a teacher in my first 10 years in the classroom, working in a school called the Susquehanna School in Binghamton, New York, which is no longer there, but we served as a kind of lab school for Binghamton University, where my husband and I both did our graduate studies. I also did my undergraduate work there. And the experience of seeing repeatedly, like being able to put the educational theory I was learning into direct practice with children, and seeing those who came into the school having had other experiences in other kinds of schools, more traditional schools, and seeing how sort of battered and worn that they were, and how they were folding almost in on themselves, and that over time they would relax and begin to bring out, you know, the mm-hmm. beauty and the talent and the passion that they had. And so at time and again, I saw the power of that to this, the kind of education, the student-centered, I mean, when, you know, there's all kinds of jargon you can use for it, you know, but active learning that puts, that gives authority and power to students to help shape their learning and to identify their strengths and talents and bring that into the classroom. I saw how powerful that was, and then connecting that to sustainability, you know, I believe deeply that in these times we need nothing more than to call on the resilience and the beauty and the talent of each and every person in order to live joyfully and meaningfully into a very different reality than we had in the last century, and the one certainly that mm-hmm. I grew up in. Right. So I saw Ithaca as a place of possibility, you know, where there would be, I would find a community of people that might be interested in exploring this idea.
Right. And in that idea, there is kind of a tension between giving them power and recognizing the power that's already there.
Yes.
And that's where it gets awkward.
That's right. It's really intense. I mean, it's and that's a, it's really cool, you know. It's, we, you know, at the educational system and what we generally accept to be normal or inevitable about education is really, you know, it's a social construct that we step into and we learn over the course of years. And so when I say giving power, I mean, like, as a structure, as a social structure of mm-hmm. as a mm-hmm. school, we do need to consciously figure out how do we empower young people, you know, within right. those constructs.
Right. And part of my I come from the a rural cooperativist kind of Christian anarchist background, mm-hmm. and so the idea that you could give power is just something that they would take as a joke from where I'm from,
right?
Because it's what you step into, mm-hmm. and the process of living is a process of discovery, which is, and it's in self-education and community-based education, mm-hmm. just by how you do farming and how you sell goods or purchase goods collectively or cooperatively, mm-hmm. Without a lot of organization, but a lot of goodwill, mm-hmm. and a lot of fighting, because mm-hmm. it's very conflict mm-hmm. Centered. One of the qualities about education, the way you are describing it, is that it's a very conflictual process, and a lot of and it's not just getting information into people. Mm-hmm. It's about them wrestling with questions and wrestling with you, their teachers, and each other to learn. How does that change? I mean, my sense is just from watching you react to my question, there's some resonance there for you.
Absolutely.
How does it shape your work?
How does it shape our work?
How does the presence of continuous tension or conflict shape your work?
I think it's a tremendous catalyst and motivator. I guess the thing that is challenging for all of us as adults, most of the people who become teachers after having a really good school experience, and not everybody, that's not across the board,
but right, no.
Many people have been good students, right? So they've deeply interiorized the values of school and education. And so the idea of that there will be that conflict or any messiness, you know, in the process feels wrong sometimes, you know, like it sure. just doesn't feel good, right? And right. so there's a tendency to want to snap back into, like, let's bring some order to this, you know?
Right.
But ultimately, you know, we have to make space within ourselves, mm-hmm. and, you know, relax and step back a little bit, and to think of ourselves as facilitators and guides rather than the sage on the stage.
Right, and it's it helps to have metaphors to make that happen. One of the ones that I try to use is that we only walk because we're continuously off balance.
Right.
And our bodies work because they are constantly, there's a tension between every muscle. You know, and without that conflict, we would be dead. And the only body without tension is a corpse before rigor sets in.
Yes, that's right.
And finding metaphors that people, that offend people initially, but then when they work with them a while, make more acceptable things that are tough.
Yes, that's a beautiful metaphor.
So, how did you migrate from personal liberation and singing your lesson plan to sensing that there needs to be some kind of institutional or organizational support for this?
Well, I think the opportunity to teach at the Susquehanna School, first of all, the guidance of teachers like Dr. Deborah Britzman, who's now in Toronto, but at the time she was the chair of the Susquehanna School. And so understanding the value of having these spaces in education that allowed teachers to really put student-centered, collaborative, cooperative theories mm-hmm. into practice in the classroom, not having any model for that, you know, that was already developed, like, here, let me teach you how to do this, right? But finding our own way with it was a way of learning the process of helping students to find their way, you know, with a rich learning process. What was your question?
No, I mean, you answered the question. Let's cut to music.
Okay.
What should we play next?
Oh, my. Get to choose. Mm-hmm. How about New Beginning by Tracy Chapman?
Okay. Here we go.
Time to start all over, make a new beginning. Too much pain, too much suffering. Let's resolve to start all over, make a new beginning. Now don't get me wrong.
Listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this episode is Tina Nilsson Hodges. So in your movement to develop your role as an educator and to develop the New Roots School, how have you had to change in ways that you would not have anticipated or necessarily have chosen?
Well, I really had to step into becoming to understand what does it mean to be a leader. Because if for the first time, I really stepped into something which was beyond my decision to sing Redemption Song, you know, or to take off on an adventure, but rather to...
And you look around and there's not everybody there sharing the responsibility for the positive and negative consequences with you. They share the positive ones, but they don't share the negative ones. There's all sorts of...
Well, that's certainly one dimension of it. And another was just understanding what do people need from me mm-hmm. as a leader. And like my, if I could visualize what I was excited about and what I anticipated in building the school was like I was a teacher. I was going to roll up my sleeves with the other teachers and we were going to make a school. And then I realized like, oh, I'm a school. Well, I didn't just realize it. I was taught it pretty quickly right. by the world around me. Sure. I'm a school administrator, and people's perceptions of what that meant were various, and they were very different than mine in a lot of respects, because I had come up through several small schools, independent schools that were founded and led by women, and led by women who had founded the schools, right? So this is actually the third in my life that is that kind of school.
Right, and there's an implicit amount of power and certain ways of establishing accountability and control that come from a founder that don't come from an established institution.
Mm-hmm, that's right, and it's also, there are a lot of issues around the question of power. And mm-hmm. as someone who's never really had never felt like I particularly had very much power, suddenly I had people telling me, you have a lot of power. It's like, wow, power to do good things. I'm excited to have that power. And how do I engage other people in sharing that power and becoming, you know, part of this collective vision and endeavor? And it turned out to be under the pressures of starting up a public school in a very short period of time, far more complicated than what I had, more intricate of a process than I had expected.
Right, right. And so what is it that you, what have you learned about yourself, and what have you learned about the nature of power in this transition?
Well, what have I learned about myself? Well, I've learned that I am extraordinarily resilient and patient and flexible. I don't know that I really knew exactly the depths of, you know, how much I had of that in terms of reserves. Mm-hmm. In terms of power, I think power is something that we all have. And as a leader, my task is to think about how to best empower or allow the power and the talent of each person to express themselves in the organization and to navigate the waters of their own, you know, everyone's skills and learning about how do they do that in relationship to other people.
Right. So I'm going to sketch out something which is kind of at the heart of my work in Shared Journeys. We need institutions because they provide the structure that gives us the ability to make plans and do things that are bigger than ourselves and do things over a long period of time. But we need community where we meet each other simply as equals and we assert without a lot of structure what we need, what we have, we share without being told. Mm-hmm. And it's not about obligation or role. Mm-hmm. Institutions are run more by roles and obligations. Mm-hmm. But in community, it's what you show up for mm-hmm. and what you personally offer or resist.
Right.
And this power is in both settings. Mm-hmm. When institutions fail, those structures that provide the scaffolding on which we build lives, they become the scaffolding upon which we're lynched. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. I mean that very seriously, because you've seen people lose their careers or lose their standing because they couldn't fit in the institution. Mm-hmm. And not mm-hmm. in every institution can fit everybody. But mm-hmm. we have to have them. Mm-hmm. And communities, when there are things that need to be done that are bigger than the individual people involved, they end up getting cowed by bullies if people do not step up mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and take on certain responsibilities that wouldn't follow the rules in an institution. Mm-hmm. So there's a lawlessness to community that isn't even possible to consider. But we live in both spaces at the same time. Mm-hmm. So and part of your education, and we've asked schools in this culture we've asked schools in the United States not to train individuals in technical roles, but also to shape persons, whole persons. Mm-hmm. Whole persons really only exist in community. whole persons never really fit in institutions. Mm-hmm. They don't know what to do with all the messy pieces mm-hmm. of their lives.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is, as the head of a school that's entrusted to do these two incompatible things, but they're essential because we do them at the same time and awkwardly, but they provide our life structure and meaning. Mm-hmm. How do you keep both agendas moving forward?
Mm. Oh, Eric, that is a really good question. First and foremost, I would say our focus is on, it really is a dual, we're tasked dually in terms of our educational theory that we're bringing into the public education system mm-hmm. through New Roots is that by creating a strong sense of community and giving students, we'll give the students capacity, the young people capacity to develop themselves and learn to be a member of a community. Mm-hmm. And that is the foundational self-development that's necessary in order for them to take on academic, vocational, you know, meaningful thinking about how can I become part of the larger community and contribute to the world. That is the task of public education, is to provide that education. And so what we're trying to do is provide that opportunity for students to, you know, essentially put a stronger foundation under what they're doing academically and vocationally. Now,
it's tailored to the persons they are.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. And really to connect them to, like, what they're doing in the classroom to the wider community, so that there's meaning and relevance, right? Yeah. I mean, we've all heard the cry time and again from teenagers, why am I learning this? So we seek to answer that question,
and
right?
And that ties them I would use the institutions more than the wider community, because they're the mm-hmm. institutions and organizations that have particular roles and particular knowledge expectations
right.
that they have when they walk out. So they're not going to have the free for all. They're not going to care about your whole life, but you need to be functional in them.
That's right. And then in terms of that, you know, on the other hand, the other side of this, sure. the other dimension, you know, being a public education institution, particularly a charter school, carries with it, you know, weighty responsibility in terms of what we're accountable for, you know, whether it's graduation rates or it's, you know, how many college credits does a student earn before they leave high school, you sure. know, all of those things. And so, you know, how do we use the power of community to enlist students into an understanding and an awareness of, you know, why does this exist and what does it mean to them that they're asked to be, you know, to come into this institution. And what I think is fascinating when you look at the history, it's not fascinating, it's rather horrible. And you see, like, some of my songs, you know, reflect, you know, kind of empowerment and thinking about this is, but, you know, if you look at the history of secondary education mm-hmm. in the United States, I mean, essentially, one of the catalysts for it was a meeting of a group of, you know, captains of industry figuring out how to create an institution that would allow them to train workers for a corporate industrial economy. So a model that was developed over 100 years ago for a very, very different time period, you know, has really persisted largely untouched.
Right. The discipline for a manufacturing job,
mm-hmm.
when it was artisan based as opposed to production line based.
That's right. Yeah. So now I haven't even said the words global climate change,
sure.
and I haven't said
yeah.
fossil fuel depletion,
right.
and I haven't said that we face a point of crisis that our young people are all too well aware of, and they need an education that meets them where they are and helps them develop who they are so that they can live into that future and create something beautiful and joyful of it that you and I won't see,
mm-hmm.
But we sure as hell hope they do, and
right.
that they're, and so do our, you know, their children and their children's children, right? So
right, and that is kind of to address the technical, the organizational, the knowledge industry problems, as the, and the values
mm-hmm.
that need to be institutionalized and organized moving forward.
Mm-hmm.
But you still have these people that are forming as persons.
Yes.
And when I was a freshman or sophomore in high school, there was a very frustrated teacher who punished the whole class for something one student did that he couldn't figure out who did it. And so he punished us all with this writing exercise. One should behave like a high school student rather than a grade school student. And we were supposed to write this for like 30 minutes, as many times as we could on a piece of paper, which is a nonsense. And and at the bottom of my paper, I wrote, "I don't believe this accomplished a damn thing." Mm. And I handed it in. And then a couple hours later, I got called to the principal's office. Mm. And the principal said to me, "You know, I know exactly why you did this. You know, and you probably on some level are right. But you can't do this.
Hmm.
You know, you're going to have to kind of work with." I mean, I was also the student who was putting up the black power, which was also for us was kind of poor white power stuff and student government stuff. But there was an effort to make it possible for us to learn how to work with systems and not completely have our lives defined by systems.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And that tension is at the heart of secondary or primary and secondary education.
Absolutely. And it's you know, developing that kind of sophistication. I don't think the way that your school approached it was very sophisticated, but a really good
insight.
It was
one
right?
unsophisticated teacher with a very understanding principal who knew how to, and had other faculty who were much more.
Mm-hmm.
Every teacher has different skills.
Mm-hmm.
And in a rural, isolated area, they didn't have a lot of choice.
Right.
About who they hired.
That's right. Absolutely. Yes, and it's fascinating how education is so formative for all of us. And so I, our question, or my question, and I'm delighted to have a community of people asking the same question, how can we make education transformative? And
but what is it that's transformed?
I'd say that what's transformed is people and their possibilities as they tap into their own power and possibility. That's, I think, so we're working on transforming or shifting the paradigm of like, how do we teach in a way that allows, that creates an environment that allows students to develop and tap into that.
What I've noticed as a chaplain and as a spiritual leader is that people find transformation when they're hit with a crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't find it if they don't have the direct perception of a crisis.
That's interesting.
And once they've reflected on the crises they've been through and they've actually lived face one that is coming at them in a way that's a little more intentional, they get somewhat more resilient.
Ah. Well, I would say adolescence is a crisis.
Yes,
in terms of like just the storm of, you know, emotion and hormone and the whole, you know, the readiness to define oneself both in relationship to peer community as well as in contrast to authority. Mm-hmm. Is it's that perfect storm in so many ways, and again adding a very different kind of social and the historical moment. We're in a very different historical moment, and that has a tremendous impact on how teenagers see themselves in relationship to authority and social structures and their own futures, right? We're completely needing to revamp the narrative around what happens next after high school and college. Well, what's next?
So I guess, and this is one of the ways that when you live with a future orientation, it tends to make you less aware of the nuances of the now.
Mm-hmm,
and this is where I worry about kind of, because across the board, trying to help people focus on the future.
Mm-hmm,
but that means that we don't really see deeply into what we have and what we need now. When I was in college, there was a saying, "This isn't the real world."
Mm-hmm.
So I said, "Well, you're not going to behave, you're not going to learn how to live until you treat it like the real world."
That's right.
Is what I was saying to my peers in college, because I was a bit of an upstart. But we have the same problem now, even more so, because the future is opaque.
Mm-hmm.
It's terrifying, but it's still opaque.
It's still opaque. That's right. And actually, I mean, you really put your finger on something that's really important to what we do. Like, how do we make life good now in this school, in this community, right?
Mm-hmm.
Live a good life now as preparation for whatever comes.
Recognizing
right?
there are problems we're not solving now, we're not dealing, we're surviving on some level now.
Yeah, we're surviving now, and we're doing the good we can do in the world right now. We're not preparing to do something 8 years from now. We're doing it right now, like today. What are we doing today that contributes to our own development, our community, our school community, and our wider community? You know, how can we be part of that interconnected whole and right. recognize our own you know, that we are part of it.
Right, right. And when you have those kinds of connections, they appear and feel somewhat opportunistic. And that's a word that has negative connotations. Mm. But without an opportunity, you can't do anything.
That's right.
And when you are living in this more open way, which is not so rigidly structured and not a total free for all of community, mm-hmm. you see these opportunities and you try. You wonder what you can do with them mm-hmm. and play with them.
That's one of the exciting things about being at New Roots Charter School and being in my role. One of the ways mm-hmm, I sure. can use my power, if you will,
sure.
is that when there are opportunities out in our wider community to connect, you know, young people and elders in our community or things that are happening, you know, I can support making that happen, and I'm so excited about that.
Right, right. And when people approach it, people who tend to be to see the power in the institution or the other, they need permission, and you almost have to show them, don't ask permission, just mm-hmm. do it. And for those who take without being aware of what others need or are doing, you have to ask them to stop, look, consider, and ask, because they need to learn something different.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's where I see you having the most power.
Mm. That's a beautiful way of putting it. Yes, thank you.
I want to cut to music, and then I want to come back to some, because we're bumping up into the way personal and what might be called spiritual or disciplines play in one's life. And you're cultivating habits of the heart, habits of life, habits of being in the world with students. And I want to talk more about your own. So
great.
What should we play next musically?
Well, I would say based on what you just brought up, I would say These Are the Days by Natalie Merchant and the 10,000 Maniacs.
Okie doke. Here we go.
Remember
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this episode is Tina Nilsson Hodges. So, Tina, we've got about 10, 15 minutes left in the show, and the way we close the show out is with this cluster of questions. One of our main jobs in life is to learn how to take care of ourselves so that we can be fully present and accounted for to be with others. But it's kind of like the oxygen mask in the airplane. You got to put yours on first before you can kind of really help others. Yes. So when did you learn to take care of yourself, or how have you been learning to take care of yourself? Because it's a lifelong thing. And how do you do it emotionally, intellectually, and physically, which for me, when you really hit all three of those deeply, adds up to spiritually.
I have to say that my most compelling call to that must have come really late in my life, you know, beyond like the ways in which I've been nurtured and supported by my relationships, like my 30-year partnership with my husband. But
where you are in a state of self and other care, but it's unselfconscious.
Right.
Yeah.
I stepped very consciously into a yoga practice about 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. I want to estimate. It was at the beginning of when Yoga Farm was just developing out in Lansing mm-hmm. with Christopher Grant. So Christopher Grant was my first yoga teacher. Mm-hmm. And I was attending yoga classes, you know, studying with Christopher maybe once a week for a period of time. And then about a year and a half ago, stepped into a more regular, like 3 or 4 times a week practice. And that led me into last fall, taking on a 200-hour yoga training, which I was, it was interesting moving from with yoga from it being a very physical practice, mm-hmm. you know, I was looking sure. for stretching and, you know, and then, you know, and it's led me very deeply into a spiritual practice. And when I say that, I mean in a non-religious kind of way, but rather right. it's deepened my understanding of and developed my own sense of, spirituality, that is an interconnection between the physical, the emotional, the mm-hmm. intellectual, and a connection between myself and everything else.
Sure, sure. And I think in this culture, we forget that up till about 150 years ago, 120 years ago, most of our jobs were extremely physical. Mm-hmm. And people who could work for 50, 60 years of their lives needed to know how to really use their bodies well. And mm-hmm. on the farm I grew up on, the old farmers who were in, when I was a little boy, they were 60 and 70 years old. They could put in a day of physical labor mm-hmm. because they knew how to move their bodies. And mm-hmm. in doing so, they were also at peace. And the younger farmers who relied more on equipment never knew how to use their bodies so well. They had not used scoops and shovels and stuff to the same degree or other equipment. Mm-hmm. So they didn't know how to really use their bodies. Mm-hmm. And you talk about becoming more aware of the spiritual side. You can look at those farmers and they would look back at you with eyes wide open mm-hmm. and behold you mm-hmm. because they weren't looking to manage you or control you, but they mm-hmm. were looking to see who you were. Mm-hmm. And that I think is a we didn't describe it in spiritual terms back then because mm-hmm. it was something to be overcome mm-hmm. by industry mm-hmm. and machinery. Mm-hmm. And now we've overcome it and we've wondered, well, what do we do with our bodies now? And yoga has right. kind of become the answer.
Absolutely. And the gift of the training that I did with a woman mm-hmm. named Erica Kaufman, mm-hmm. Who's in State College, Pennsylvania. So I took off to State College, Pennsylvania for 7 weekends, actually 8. And it culminated with a trip to India in January. So mm-hmm. the very first time in 10 years that I've stepped out of the day-to-day flow at New Roots Charter School.
Right.
Totally.
Basically, 10-day
sabbatic. That's exactly what it was. And, you know, knowing that the school was held by a phenomenal team of educators and you know, was able to step out and into this experience in India.
So how did this, why did you choose this deepening? What specifically were you experiencing that wanted you to learn more, that made you want to learn more about yoga and to take on this?
Well, it was I went to a workshop with Erica, and Erica really pulls together the connection between the energy and life of the earth and the energy and life that we experience. Mm-hmm. And at the end of that weekend, I said, Erica, you know, and she speaks poetry. She's mm-hmm. just her, the way that she articulates that relationship is beautiful. And she's developed a morning practice that that I've learned over the course of my training that gives me a way of really grounding and centering to start the day. Mm-hmm. And I confess that I still am pulled to, like, wake up in the morning and in those quiet hours take on my administrator duties. But more and more I'm gravitating to that morning practice as a way of starting the day.
Hmm. Neat. And you mentioned that this is preparing you for emotional connection in a way that you hadn't been prepared before. How is that changing your daily life?
Well, I think it's more connecting with myself.
Okay.
and my own, you know, keeping grounded and centered and feeling a nice energy flow for myself. You know, emotional connection is something that I you know, I've always lived in that beautiful
right.
mix.
And I guess what I was wondering about was more, a lot of our emotional connections are reactive until we recognize the centeredness of both ourselves and others, and then they become more engaged and less reactive on
both
ends.
Yes, that's a really nice way to put it. Absolutely. Found new roots in community with others in the particular role that I have been in has required a tremendous outpouring of energy over the last decade for me. And
absorbing the projections of others on your role of power and authority.
Absolutely. That has been very that has been very intense, and I've learned a lot from that experience. And yoga has given me a way of bringing myself into balance, my emotional energy, my mm-hmm. spiritual energy, and also, you know, I would also link with that early on in the time of New Roots, I also learned the Transcendental Meditation Technique, which is, you know, the yoga training gave me the context to understand the relationship between meditation and, you know, the more physical practices
of
yoga.
Sure. Yeah. Neat. So what happened in you that made you open to taking on yoga 3 or 4 years ago that maybe hadn't noticed it or engaged it before? What had changed?
I think I was at a point finally where I could step more into I guess what I would call my own life and my own self-care after many years. I mean, at that point, while New Roots was just launching and getting off the ground, my own children were in middle and high school. For many, many years, you know, just simply full on, like I said, getting up in the morning, the
survival mode.
Right? Yeah. And giving, you know, giving everything that I had to give each mm-hmm. and every day. And I think that, you know, there was a point where it was, you know, it was just time. That way opened up for me, and I was able to give more back to myself, to feeding my, you know, my own self, my development and my, you know, my energy, because I was just at a different juncture with all that I was giving as a mother and as someone birthing a school, if you will.
Right. And how do you take care of yourself intellectually?
I enjoy so much the people that I know in my life at New Roots and also at Eco Village at Ithaca, where I live. And I also love to find time to retreat to the corner of the couch with my books mm-hmm. and my Kindle and with my cat and, you know, just take time for that kind of reflection and connection to bigger ideas. Sure. I do confess I do not get as much of that time as I would like to.
No, but you're also in an environment where ideas are ping-ponging off every surface imaginable.
Absolutely. That's true.
It doesn't have the sustained quality, but it does have a constant presence.
Yes.
And is yoga your primary method of physical renewal? Or?
Yes, it is. Although I love to walk. I love to walk the gorges. And, you know, time outside is also really important to me and has been historically.
Tina, it's been really wonderful to get to know you.
Likewise, Eric.
So what should we close the show with? What song should we close the show with?
I would say I would really like to close with Revolution at Hand by Thousands of One, honoring a local musician who became the Dean of Student Life at New Roots Charter School. And as I was looking back at that album, choosing a song that I thought would be the best song, I would say that we are, Jakeem and I are seeking the necessary revolution together, and looking at the CD cover, the mission of Thousands of One, very much like my own, end racism, achieve sustainability, connect with creation.
Here we go. Thank you, Tina.
Thank you.
Stars shine bright, making last an illusion. Fools confuse this for temporary pleasure. Wise, they use this for necessary measure. Hands together, never divided. Usher the wind from another room fire. God make a heart to bring us to the top. A place where weapons can never stop us. Sinai Mountain, only devout can carry the promise. Ark of the covenant, power is hovering between the cherubim. Ancient aquarium defy laws of gravity. One rope fallacy, ghetto malice. Fall to the throne of a blessing monotone. Doom, doom, making room for the bass drum. Doom, doom, making room for the bass drum. Hello, my friends. Did you forget you've been sent, oh, to carry a word? Refugees, go home. Revolution at hand. The least must arise as the greatest of them all. Prophets harmonize. Of losing sight and the vision of a ghetto epidemic. Hip-hop music created to come against it. Invented, even relevance is a path and a method to get boys to the trenches. Hip-hop sentenced to a vision of a promised land. Above all creation, set beyond the hands of the need for the greed, propaganda industry. Soldiers are lost in the Babylon fiends. They sell their soul, hoping for gold. Playing the fool to be part of the bone. It's a game that they play.